Welcome to the Voices from the Frontline segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. My name is Manuel Criollo, and I'm here with my co-host, Eric Mann. On today's show, we will have some important voices from the front lines. First, we'll have Rahul Mahajan, writer, anti-war activist, and blogger, who will talk to us about George Bush's inauguration speech, its implications to the world, the upcoming Iraqi elections, and even the recent unveiled foreign policy notes from the CIA that says that will rely on covert operatives, designated killings, random acts of violence, and terrorist act. Nothing new from the U.S., some attempt to bring down unfriendly governments to maintain U.S. hegemony throughout the world. And then later on the show, we'll be joined by Craig Gilmore, organizer with the California Prison Moratorium Project, and an activist with No New Jail Coalition, who'll be talking to us about the upcoming Los Angeles City Council vote to support a citywide additional half-cent sales tax to put more police on L.A. streets. We'll be hearing from Craig to talk to us about the grassroots opposition to this measure. And also stay tuned up next, because we'll hear from my co-host Eric Mann in his weekly commentary. So stay tuned.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. It's the 4 o'clock hour. This is Eric Mann. Did you take off? Did you tell your boss like we told you? My day ends Monday at 4 because I have to listen to KPFK 90.7. We hope so. Today I'm going to start by talking about the Bush administration, which everybody talks about, but then talk about what we can do about it, which a lot of people don't. I want to do a lot of quoting from a very chilling article in the Saturday Los Angeles Times entitled Bush Pulls Neocons Out of the Shadows. And this is from the Los Angeles Times this Saturday. In the unending struggle of American foreign policy that consumes much of official Washington, one side claimed a victory this week, the neoconservatives, that determined band of hawkish idealists who promoted the U.S. invasion of Iraq and now seem to bring democracy to the rest of the Middle East. For more than a year, since the occupation of Iraq turned into the Bush administration's biggest headache, many of the neocons have lowered their profiles and muted their rhetoric. During President Bush's re-election campaign, Deputy Defense Secretary Paul D. Wolfowitz, one of the leading voices for invading Iraq, virtually disappeared from public view, except if you saw Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11. But on Thursday, Bush proclaimed in his inaugural address that the central purpose of his second term would be the promotion of democracy, quote, in every nation and culture, with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world, a key neoconservative goal. Suddenly, the neocons were ascendant again. If Bush means it literally, then it means we have an extremist in the White House, said Dimitri Symes, president of the Nixon Center, a conservative think tank that reveres the less idealistic policies of Richard Nixon. I hope and pray that he didn't mean it and that it was merely an inspirational speech, not practical guidance for the conduct of foreign policy. Well, unfortunately, this is me speaking, he does mean it. Quote, at our confirmation hearings this week, Secretary of State designate Condoleezza Rice named 6 countries as outposts of tyranny. That's, I guess, different from the axis of evil, that would get special attention from the second-term Bush administration: Cuba, Burma, North Korea, Iran, Belarus, and Zimbabwe. On Friday, the senior official who briefed reporters and said the administration also would be pressing friendly regimes to institute democratic reforms. He mentioned Russia, China, Pakistan, and Egypt as illustrations. Much of the pressure, he said, would be private rather than public, and the administration would be careful to avoid undermining a leader like Pakistan President Pervez Musharraf, whom it counts as a democratic reformer. Another senior official, a prominent neoconservative who refused to be named, said Bush's theme reflected several lessons learned in the last 30 years. Chief among them, he said, was an argument that neoconservatives often made about the Soviet Union and more recently Iraq, that a central goal of the United States would be systematic change, changing hostile states' regimes, not merely their policies. And then finally, skipping a few paragraphs, another sign of the administration's bent. Several of the leading realists of the first term, notably Secretary of State Colin L. Powell and his closest aides, have left. But leading neoconservatives, including Wolfowitz, are staying. At least one National Security Council aide, Elliot Abrams, is said to be in line for a more prominent job at the State Department or National Security Council. Well, during the election, we talked about the Bush administration as a counter-revolution. There's an element that you have to sort of give this guy credit, because unlike the liberals and unlike the left, he moves ahead with dispatch with his program. He ran in 2000 as a compassionate conservative, and the day he got in office, and after stealing the election, or putting it rather, the Democrats giving him the election, Bush began to cut off any kind of aid to any U.S. or international institutions that promoted or discussed birth control. He did that in, I think, the first or second day of his regime. Notice that he did not run during this election on the privatization of Social Security. John Kerry never could pin him down on this and make it into a big thing. The day he got elected, he said, I have a lot of capital in the bank. I have 3 million votes capital, and I'm moving for the partial privatization of Social Security. So then the question is, how fast this guy moves. Now you look on the other side. Where's the alternative? Because one of the things on KPFK is, and one of the things on the left, is we spend a lot of time critiquing Bush, but our fundamental question is, what are we going to do about it? So let's look at the crisis of the Democratic Party. Some props to Barbara Boxer, who ran who supported the first senator who stood up with John Conyers and at least allowed a challenge to the election, first Democratic person, senator who did that. And then very rapidly they moved through and said, all right, you want to have a vote, we'll have a vote on it. And then the whole Congress voted and said the election's good. So it's very good what Barbara Boxer did, but there was no organized alternative. The efforts, her challenging of Condoleezza Rice's nomination was done very well and very aggressively on the issue of Iraq. She and this time Kerry, which is interesting, voted against Condoleezza Rice. It seems like if Kerry wants to run again in 4 years, I thought, he's beginning to realize that he's better start building a voting record against this administration. He can't do what he did last time, which is vote for everything they do and then at the end of it say, I changed my mind, when he was a flip-flopper. So the encouraging thing a little bit is Kerry's more aggressive role. But if you look at the Democratic Party as a whole, it's an absolute disaster. It has a very strong right wing, the southern white people in the Democratic Party are very conservative. And basically, it's not offering, this is not a big surprise to most of you out there, it's not organizing a coherent alternative. What's really shocking to me is how effective and rapidly Bush is moving. I mean, he's moving on the privatization of Social Security. I was saying to somebody, comparing it, if you pardon our little delusions of grandeur here for a minute, the Bus Riders Union is an example of what we think the left should be doing. I'll give an example. We have four things in front of the federal courts right now. We have a consent decree with the Los Angeles MTA that expires in 2006. We have a proposal in there for 5 more years or 6 more years to extend the consent decree. We have a proposal of contempt of court against the MTA for delaying its delaying its implementation of the consent decree. We have a proposal to bring back about 270,000 service hours that the MTA has cut over the last 5 years. And now we have a proposal in front of the federal courts for 600 new buses and 50 jitneys for over $1.5 billion. Now picture yourself in the MTA's position. They're going, okay, we can't let them get a 5-year extension. We have to fight the 5-year extension. Maybe they'll get a 3-year extension. Maybe they'll get a 2-year extension. Or maybe if we win, we'll only have the 10-year consent decree. Maybe we'll try to take 600 buses away from them. Maybe they'll only get 300 buses. Maybe we won't be held in contempt of court. We will be just in the present situation, and maybe they won't get all the service hours cut. But on all four of those, we are the aggressor. All they can do is break even. The best they can do is what we already have. Every single thing that we have in front of the courts is to give us more. And they are sitting there with their lawyers afraid of the offensive that we put on them. We think we're going to win 2, 3, 4, all four possibly of those rulings. But it, as I was saying to Deborah Orris, one of our organizers who just submitted this terrific new service plan in front of the federal courts, we're in such a strong position of aggression against the MTA that they have to be playing defense. Now you bring it back to Bush and the Democrats. What in the heck are the Democrats putting in front of Bush? Trying to stop Condoleezza Rice, which they can't. Trying to stop Gonzalez from being right, the Attorney General, which they can't. Trying to stop what? Cuba? The Democrats are not going to stop an invasion of Cuba. Too frightened that they would be appeared to be friendly to a socialist country. Stop an invasion of Iran, perhaps. But the point is, Bush is putting the agenda on, you know, does he get Iran and Cuba? Does he get privatization and privately meeting with China? So then we have the final dilemma, which is the dilemma of the left, that it would be very easy to just critique the Republicans or give them even credit for their organizing, then to critique the Democratic Leadership Council. Do you realize there's not even a Democratic Liberal Council? That there's a liberal caucus in the Democratic Party. I don't know who it's made of. It used to be made up of like Paul Wellstone and four other guys that would go to lunch and cry, you know. And now with Wellstone dying, I'm not even sure they have a liberal caucus, but it's certainly nothing that any of our listeners have heard to. There's a black congressional caucus, which is very split. It's as close to a liberal caucus as you have because it's the most progressive grouping of voters in the Congress, most of whom are, as you know, in the Congress, with only Barack Obama as the first black senator. And then we have the left. And the problem is that, you know, every time I listen to people on the left saying things like, you know, well, we're not going to vote for the Democratic Party anymore, which I would be happy not to do, or we are going to unite with the Democratic Party one more time, if because God knows, you know, at the rate we're going, when we have Newt Gingrich running in 2008, or I know Schwarzenegger, people are petrified that Schwarzenegger is going to pass this, you know, immigrants can't get a driver's license, but immigrants can run for president if they're Nazis from Austria, you know, kind of thing, you know. So you got him taking the initiative, and then you have the left, and the left is saying, this is the last time I'm doing this, or this is the last time I'm doing that. And my question to the left is, and my question to every listener is this, who do you represent? How many people do you have in your organization? Do you go door to door? Do you work in a workplace? Do you have a left caucus? Do you have a left community organization that you're trying to build? Are you working in communities of color? If you're white, have you ever come down to the MTA to support a simple thing like the Bus Riders Union fighting the MTA? You have your anti-war marches, which I march in, no blood for a while. You walk around in a circle and go home and don't represent Jack. So the fundamental problem is not with the Republicans. It's not even with the Democrats, because most of us don't expect much of them. The fundamental problem is with the U.S. left, that it can't organize its way out of a paper bag. It is racially very, very divided, with the whites having regressed terribly on the issue of racism and concern for the programs and community of color. Bush is making tremendous inroads into communities of color, and you will discuss this in another thing, but let's not underestimate that he got rid of a black man, Secretary of State, to replace him with a black woman, and he has a Latino up for Attorney General with Clint,